Welcome in to a new episode of Behind the Bench, where we sit down with Anaheim Ducks coaches. And I am Alexis Downey, pleased today to be joined by new assistant coach, Tim Army. Tim, welcome back to Anaheim. I know it's a place you're familiar with, but how's it been going since you got back?
It's been great. It's odd to be back. Like, you never expect you'd come back. We loved it here. But all these years later to come back, 30 plus years later to come back has been, is really a lot of fun. Crow and I known each other for years. Our careers have kind of paralleled each other. So that in itself, we've always competed against each other. So it's been a great, it's been fun, you know, work joining with him. The staff is great. You know, I like to have some more wins right now, but still, you know, it's always, you're working towards getting better every day. But no, it's great. It's different because the practice facility is different. We used to practice. We actually started at Glacial Gardens years ago, and then it became Disney Ice, which I think is now Anaheim Ice. And so now the practice facility at Great Park, and it was the Arrowhead Pond of Anaheim then. Now it's the Honda Center, and the locker room is completely different. So it's different in that sense. So I like that because it's newer. But it is a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun being back. It's just fun coaching. Coaching is coaching. That's what I do. That's what you want to do. So it's just always, every day you get up and you go to the rink is exciting wherever you're coaching. And now here in Anaheim, it's been a long journey, but yeah, it's been great being back.
I'm really excited to dive into that journey, but how full circle this is. I want to start with just your early years here. I mean, you were here at the start of the Mighty Ducks here in Anaheim. What was it like back then? You know, you alluded to the facilities being different, but what was it like in those early first couple seasons of this team?
It was new. So you have an expansion team, and it wasn't an expansion team like Vegas or Seattle. They were real expansion teams. Mm-hmm. You were getting players that teams were making available. You weren't selecting like the current expansion teams have. It was real expansion team then. And that's a fact. And so when we first came, it was hired in July of 93. Ron Wilson was the head coach and Jack Furrer was the general manager. There weren't even offices yet. Mm. So over by Disney, I think it was a Marriott or a Sheraton. The team offices were in the hotel. So I remember Ron bringing Al Sims and myself. We'd come out to look for a place to live with our wives. And we went to the hotel to meet Jack. I knew Jack from back east because Jack was a scout for years, had been a GM in Minnesota. But to go see Jack, meet Pierre, Gauthier. So, and then Ron took us for a tour of what was then the pond. Mm-hmm. The Anaheim Bullfrogs were playing there. Mm. They were playing the inline hockey. And there were no ceiling tiles in the locker room, the old locker room. Now, of course, it's been renovated and so forth. But so that's going back to the early stages. And then, yeah, we were a real expansion team. And Jack had been through Calgary. When Calgary was trying to close the gap on the great Edmonton Oilers teams, what they decided to do was get bigger and more physical. Mm-hmm. So Jack, when he was part of the expansion in San Jose, when he came to Anaheim, he was going to build a tough team. So we had Stu Grimson, Todd Ewan, Troy Loney, Robin Bauer, Jimmy Thompson. These guys, we were really tough and physical. And that first year, we exceeded expectations. Mm-hmm. I think we had 34 wins. At that time, we broke a record for road wins. The Panthers had a great year as well. They had more points than we did, but I think we broke a record for road wins on an expansion team. But we were really tough and physical. And then we had some guys step up that year, Terry Yake, Bobby Corkum. They scored 20 plus goals. They had drafted Paul in 93. Paul hadn't come yet. And so we had an identity and we were hard to play against. And we had a really good year as an expansion team would go, one of the best expansion years under the old system. And so you're kind of establishing an identity. When I interviewed with Ron, we interviewed at the Marriott Hotel in Providence, not far from Providence College, where Ron went to school and I went to school. Mm. And Ron had played high school hockey with my brothers at East Providence High School, my brothers Tommy and Bill. So I knew the Wilson boys. We were very close. Mm-hmm. Ron said to me, there was a book called Building a Champion by Bill Walsh, the 49ers coach at the time. And Ron said, this is what we're going to do in Anaheim. Ooh. And it was exciting that we were going to start at the ground level. And so the first year was, we started to build an identity. It was built on size and toughness. We did have some skill guys that had some good years. Like I said, Terry Yake had a great year. Bobby Carpenter, Joe Sacco, I think, had 16 goals. Billy Holder was good on the back end. Sean Hill, Guy Bear and Ron Tugnet gave a great tandem in goaltending. We eventually traded Tugger for Stefan LeBeau late in the season, and Mikhail Stolenkov came in, and that would guide us. He and Guy would be our two guys. Guy was as the lead guy through the next three years after that. And so we got to start to build that identity and build a champion. The next year went into the lockout year. So 94 was a lockout. I think it hurt us. Paul came that year. Paul was up for Rookie of the Year. That shortened season, it was a 48-game season. We didn't play quite as well as we had the year before. I think the lockout kind of stalled our momentum a bit, and the team began to change. And that led to 95-96 when Paul scored 50 that year, and Paul really started to establish himself as a star in the NHL. But we traded for Tamu. Jack traded for Tamu later that season, and that sort of changed the whole dynamic, obviously, with Paul and Tamu and Steve Ruchin. We were drafted in the old supplemental draft. So by 95-96, we were becoming a real threat. And we actually tied Winnipeg for eighth place in the conference. They had more wins, so they got the playoff berth, although we had beaten them three out of four that year. And then that led to 96-97, the first playoff year. When we ended fourth, we had a great seven game series against Phoenix at the time, and then we beat them in game seven here at the Pond 3-0, and then we lost in four games to Detroit, went on to win it. But Scotty Bowman said there was an overtime game, a double overtime game, and a triple overtime game in that series. And Scotty Bowman said to Ron during the handshake line, he said called it a six game sweep because the games went so long.
Yeah.
We played as well as we could. They were just better than us. But you could feel it coming. And so it takes me back to that conversation with Ron that day, building a champion. That was kind of the progress to 96-97. Unfortunately, Ron and I were fired right after Memorial Day that year, and we ended up going to Washington the next year, where we went to the finals, and the Ducks didn't make the playoffs, so it was kind of like, okay, how's that working for you? But we won't get into that. But but that was how it was kind of in those early years. We were Disney-owned, so we did a parade at Disneyland before we even played our first game against Detroit in 93.
Were you in the parade?
I was in the parade. We were in these little, you went around Main Street and the little area, that little circular area you'd go around. And then we had another parade. We went to another function at Disney, and Bobby Dallas, one of our defensemen, said at the time, "This is great. We haven't won a game yet. We've already had two parades." So it had a little bit of that Disney element to it, but it was really exciting. The movie had come out, and the Mighty Ducks, and it's ironic because I remember the movie, and it was fun to go see, and it was a great movie. And then I got hired. But before I got hired, I was working a hockey camp at Exeter, New Hampshire. I actually was an assistant coach at Providence College at the time. And a young kid had a hat on and had the Ducks logo on. It's the first time I ever saw it. I'm like, that's really cool. Because I didn't know if they're going to come out like the movie jersey. I didn't know. I did just as a hockey fan. I'm like, that's really cool. Ironically, within a couple of days, Ron was trying to reach out to me. So within about 2 weeks from that moment, I'm hired by the Ducks.
It was a sign.
So it was really exciting. You know, I was, I was 96. So I was just turned 30, and we came out that first time to find a place to live, Sue and I, and, Ron took us to Disney. You know, what's that club that they have? The club. We went to dinner at the club.
Okay.
That special club you get into. And they you see the fireworks. Club 33 or something like that. We went to that. And then we saw the fireworks. And I remember sitting there with my wife, like, what's happening? Like how do we end up here? Like, this is incredible. And you know what? Our life would never be the same from that moment. From the moment I said yes to Ron, he called me at home. The night after we had interviewed, And I said, you want to move to Anaheim? And my wife was screaming upstairs. We had two little boys that were just little at the time. And but our life has never been the same since then. And I mean that in an extremely positive way. I never envisioned career-wise or family-wise we would go on this journey. And it's never that moment. It's been such an enriching life since then.
That's amazing. It's so like full circle that you're back here and you get to see how different things are as well. But you touched on it, getting to be a part of that Korea Sahlani, getting to be there during that trade. How magical was it watching those two?
It was to this day, I've never seen two players play as fast as those two guys played, and they fit so well. You know, you look at Nashville right now and you add Stamkos and mm-hmm. Brady Shea and Marchessault, but it doesn't always fit. Sometimes it just doesn't fit. You think it might, but until guys start to play together, you don't know if they'll fit. And the two of them just fit. And Steve Ruchin, you don't hear all the time in the conversation, those two guys will tell you. Mm-hmm. But Steve Ruchin was the perfect center for both those guys. So it fit as a line. But from the moment Tamu came, you could feel things change. Obviously, he'd scored 76 goals in 92, 93. He was an elite player. Ironically, he had got caught in his Achilles tendon in a game in our building in 94. Donnie McSween, they came together on the boards and Don Skate cut Tamu on his Achilles, and Tamu missed the rest of the year and took him some time to come back from that. And I actually met Tamu at the World Championships that spring in 94. Mm. They were in Bolzano in Canizze, Italy. Ron brought me as one of his assistants. Guy was our goalie on that team. We got to the medal round. Guy played unbelievable, and he hurt his groin, but in that tournament. But got to know Tamu. So again, it's kind of odd how all these things sort of, I met him in an elevator and we were chatting, and nice guy. Then I saw him a couple days later, just walking around the facilities, and then he would end up here. But it just fit. Paul was extremely serious, driven. Tamu was driven, but in a different way. His personality was mm-hmm. lighter. And I think the personalities fit, and I think they brought out different things in each other, which were really good for both of them. And their styles just fit. And you just have to watch the goal in game 6 in Phoenix in 97. We'd won the first two games of the series fairly emphatically here. We lost the next two in Phoenix. We lost game 5 here. We did not play. We were really sort of flat. So we had to go into Phoenix to win. And we were up 2-0. They tied it late. We went into overtime. And if you ever watch the goal, you can get it on YouTube. Tamu got a puck like at the hash marks or in our end, and he kind of pitched it, kind of floated a high flip. And I've never seen anybody skate as fast as Paul to get that puck. So he came down by our bench. And as Paul got to the puck, I think he was in a foot race with a defenseman named Gerald Diddick, a really good defenseman. Paul got to the puck, and the puck kind of turned up on end just as Paul got it inside the blue line. And Nikolai Habibulin was a very, very good goalie. And Paul kind of caught it, never really was on a stick very long. He just kind of buggy whipped it over the glove inside the far post and in. And I can still picture it, but it was sort of Paul and Tamu. You know, Tamu getting something to Paul in an area where Paul could use his speed. They both did it both ways. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I've never seen two guys play that fast together. And, we end up winning that game, obviously, on Paul's goal. And we came home, beat him 3-0 in game 7. And we kind of beat him emphatically in game 7, but here at the pond. But, they were phenomenal players. The speed that they played with was incredible. Paul did things sort of quicker. Mm-hmm. Tamu was sort of, in those days, you kind of call them half-court players. Like an Adam Oates was kind of a half-court player. Tamu had a little bit more hold it until you almost fall off the fence to make a play, where Paul did everything 100 miles an hour. I've never seen anybody accelerate like the two of them. So the way they complemented one another, the speed that they play with, the skill level they played with, the hockey sense that they had, the way they could feed off of each other, it happened from day one. I think Tamu's first game was on the island when we traded for him. I think the first time We saw him as a duck, was at the Marriott Hotel across the parking lot from the old Nassau County Coliseum. And they just fit from day one. And like I said, Rooch was phenomenal with the two of them. The line just fit. And by 97, when we made that playoff run, there were teams around the league that were beginning to say they want to try to model themselves after us here in Anaheim. So then I think back to Ron and the book, Building a Champion, and we were kind of on that track.
Right.
It was exciting. It was exciting to watch those two guys. Like I said, the pace that they played with was incredible. And you're going back 30 years now, and the guys are getting faster and faster. But it's like watching Bobby Orr, the pace that he played with, or Pavel Bure, the pace that Paul and Tamewood played at was incredible. But they played it with skill and intelligence. And they played off each other. It was really, as a coach, it was really exciting to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. I remember saying to Paul, he scored 50 in 95, 96. He scored 50 the last game of the year against Winnipeg. And I remember leaning down, it's one of the most, he scored his 50th. And as things settled, I went down to him on the bench. It's one of the most exciting things I've ever seen. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun as a coach. It was really exciting.
Have you gotten to see them since you've been back?
No, I haven't seen them. I haven't seen Paul. I was coaching in Colorado. I was coaching with Patrick Waugh. It was 2013-14. We came in here and beat the Ducks the last game of the season, which put us in a position. We won the Central Division, which meant we were going to play Minnesota. We were kind of gearing to play Chicago. I saw Paul after that game because Paul had played in St. Louis with Eric Johnson. So I saw Paul then, the first time I'd seen him in a while. So I got to catch up with him. I saw Tamu a couple of years later when I came in with the Avs, kind of bumped into him underneath the Honda Center. Mm-hmm. So it was nice to see them. But I exchanged texts with them when they were inducted in the Hall of Fame. But I haven't seen them since we come back, so I'm excited to see them. Just to catch up. Those were the great memories.
And your coaching career, I mean, you've talked about it. It's taken you so many places since those early days here in Anaheim. Was coaching always the plan for you when you stopped playing hockey, or did you just kind of fall into it?
I think after I stopped playing, I actually went, when I played at Providence College and I went to Providence, studied political science. I thought I'd go to law school. And I thought I wanted to get involved in politics. I thought I'd become a senator from Rhode Island. At Providence, I had a good run at Providence. And then I played a year in the American League. Then I played a year over in Europe. And when I came back, I thought coaching would be a good avenue. And back then, I just didn't, I had a chance to go back to Europe. I didn't really want to. So ironically, Mike McShane was the head coach at Providence College at the time. This is the summer of 87. And the assistant there, Rich Milley, who eventually became the head coach at UNH, was leaving. And Mike offered me the job. So it was kind of a no-brainer. I was actually going to go teach school. I was actually going to go to a private school called Portsmouth Abbey in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. I was going to teach history and coach hockey and baseball, manage a baseball team.
Oh.
And then, because I played baseball through high school. And then we actually had moved to Portsmouth Abbey, my wife and I. We didn't have any children yet. And Mike offered me the job. So I had to go see the headmaster, Catholic priest. It's a Catholic prep school. And I had to tell him that, you know, I really wanted to go. He said, I didn't think I'd have you here very long, but I didn't realize it'd be this short. So I went to Providence with Mike, and then I was there for 6 years, and then I ended up coming on board here with Ron. At that point, when my career ended, yeah, I thought I would enjoy coaching. Mm-hmm. I never thought I'd coach in the NHL. Mm. I didn't know I envisioned that. I thought my goal at that point was to become the head coach of Providence College. Mm. That's what I thought would be my avenue. So what's been laid out in front, that's why I think that night at Disneyland, when we first came out in July of 93, I'm like, how are we here? What's happened?
Yeah.
And from that moment on, yeah, life has not been the same. And I mean that in a very, like I said, enriching way, in such a life experience way. Our family, it's really cool when you're So we have two boys, Derek and Travis. So we came, Derek was two, Trav was just 6 months old when we came here in 93. And when you move like that as a family of four, you really rely on each other, you know? Mm-hmm. So you go into all sorts of, so forget the professional side of it. The personal side of it is you really become really close because you're going into areas you don't know anybody. So you got to find your way. The boys have to find their way. Hardest on the oldest boy because he's the first doing everything. So he can bring his little brother along, but mm-hmm. we're doing everything together. There's no family with us. So Christmas or New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, whatever, Super Bowl, whatever it happens to be, we're doing it as a family. And so now as the boys, we have our own grandchildren now. Derek is married, has two. We have two grandchildren through Derek and his wife, Jenny. Our youngest son, Travis, is going to get married in September. He's working in Boston. His fiance, Ellie, lives in Boston. So we have this family connection. So I watched Derek and Jenny raise their kids, and they're doing things like we did with them. And then you go, okay, so, you know, painting with sidewalk chalk, making a rink on a patio in the backyard over here in Orange when we were living here. He's doing the same type of stuff. So, so those kind of things, like, so life, both professionally and personally, from that moment and all these travels, there's such a deep feel to it, mm-hmm. and it affects your life in so many ways. I never envisioned that. So when I wanted to get into coaching, I never thought I would be sitting here at 61 years old, mm-hmm. experiencing all of this. If that makes any sense.
No, it does. And that's wonderful that now you get to see, you know, the next generation adapting just like how your kids kind of adapted there too. And when you started coaching, you had that familiarity being in Providence, you know, the place you went to school, you played there. Did that kind of help you in that transition from athlete to coach and just the middle ground between that?
I think so. The first year I coached at Providence, I didn't really want to be a coach. I was doing it. I wanted to be a coach, but I still had that urge. I want to keep playing still. So for me, practice was more like not so much teaching. I want to jump in the drills. Mm-hmm. I wanted to play 3-on-3 after practice. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, if it was a day we just had a small group, I didn't want to do drills. I wanted to go play. Mm-hmm. So by my summer of 88, a fellow named Scott Borick, he was the other assistant with me at Providence at the time. Scott is now the head coach of Merrimack College. He's had a great career himself. Mm. When he left, and that was me with Mike, I'm like, okay. I was actually going to go back to Denmark and play.
Oh.
And when Scotty left, I said, I can't do that to Mike because Mike gave me an opportunity. I can't do that. And that was the moment I'm like, okay, now you're a coach. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, that sort of hoping to play was gone. And now I was young still. But that was the summer of 88. I'm like, okay. Yeah, it's time. I'm dialed in to be a coach. And that sort of was the base, the foundation that set the stage, you know, for the rest of my career, the next 37 years, so to speak.
What are some of the fundamentals that, whether you've been told things from some of your coaching mentors or other people, that you bring to your coaching style?
I guess it's like a comedian. Milton Berle used to always say, you know, every comedian steals stuff, but you got to make it your own kind of thing, right? So you're always watching. You got to make things your own. There are certain elements of advice that I got from people that helped me sort of stay inside the lines, if you will. So Mike McShane told me the first time he hired me, Mike said, you're going to be gone a lot. So when you're home, you're home. Mm. Which is interesting when you think about it, right? Mm-hmm. So then you don't really realize it then because we were just married. We were married a year or maybe 2 years at the time. It's just the two of us. And, you know, you can visit friends and you can bop around and do, but then as soon as we start to have kids, then you start to realize what that really meant. When I got hired here, Jack Ferreira said to me, you'll never watch a game the same way anymore. Mm. And it's true. So when I watch a game now, you're not just watching the game. Even if I watch Edmonton, Florida in game seven. I'm not watching the game. I'm watching the game because I enjoy it, but I'm looking at what are they doing? How are they counteracting that? Challenging myself. Who's he putting out in this situation? Are they going to make an adjustment here? So you watch the game tactically, both from on the ice and also the coach's strategy of managing their players. And so, and then the thing that Ron told me was, you have to take, because when I was at Providence as an assistant, you play Friday, Saturday. You have till the next Friday generally to prepare. He said, you got to take a week's worth of preparation now and get it done in about the most 36 hours. So, and you do, and especially in the NHL. I've coached a long time in the American League. It's a little bit different. It's a little more like a college schedule in the sense you got a week to get ready for games, but this is basically every other night. And so you got to condense everything and you have to do, the quality of the work has to be the same. So those are some examples of some advice over the years that to this day have been a part of the fabric, I think, of what my foundation is as a coach. And then there's, so you see different ways of doing things. You watch different people, how they handle situations. The generations change. So now you've got Generation Z, which is completely different. I'm a baby boomer.
I was going to say, you know, how do you connect with some of these younger generations? It's completely different.
You have to get to know, how they operate, how they handle themselves on a daily basis. And that first, I first recognized that when I was coaching the Iowa Wild a few years back in Des Moines, Iowa, Minnesota's affiliate in the American League. I started to realize that. So if I had a player in, they couldn't give me a lot. I'm always like, give me something that's deep in your soul. Tell me, I want something of substance. Just don't, we don't work hard enough. I don't know what that means. What, give me something that's deep, that's in your soul. They don't express themselves. And I don't mean it as a criticism. You know, every generation is different.
Everyone's different.
I mean, it's no right or wrong. You know, I'm from a generation where, you didn't do something right. Your father cracked you right in the back of the head at the dinner table. You talked back to your mother, you got cracked right there. It was the done. You know, I didn't do that with my kids, you know, and it was changed. So I you know, that's a fact. That's the reality of it. So the old days when your mother said, wait till your dad gets home. It was coming. Like it was coming. So you better be on your toes. But what I found was they might text me when they got back to their apartment or wherever they were living. And it was significant. So it was what I wanted verbally, but they expressed better through sort of technology, if you will. So it's getting to understand that, getting to understand how they've been raised. And so I think you have to have an understanding. Again, it's not right or wrong. It's the reality of it. So you've got to kind of understand, how can you reach them? How can you connect with them? And how can you get them to understand what they need to do to be better? What they need to do to be better. And so that's getting to understand that part of it. And if you don't, it won't happen. So, and again, there's no right or wrong. It's the reality of it. You know, so that's part of it. And then, you got to get connected on a deeper level so that you're both working towards the same thing. You want that player to elevate because if that player can elevate, it's good. Obviously, it's great for him individually, but it's also got to fit into the collective whole. So it's a whole process. But you also, in the old days, somebody told you something, you just did it. You told a player to do something, they just did it. It's different now. And so they're more involved in it. They're more people as they grow up that give them input. So I don't think they're any smarter than I was at, you know, 18 years old or 22 years old, but they have more information. And so, you gotta, you gotta recognize that. And so it becomes kind of a give and take. It's good to challenge them. What do you see? What do you think? What did you see in the situation? They kind of give it back to you. And then you get a better sense. And then you kind of go back to them. Well, what about this? What do you think of this? And then you kind of work towards that. And that's where it's a little bit different. I was coaching in Washington in 99. We went to the finals in 98. We got swept by Detroit in the final. The next year we missed the playoffs. We ran into injuries. We had a bit of a hangover, which is reality. But we lost in Carolina one night and we were not good. And Ron was really upset. So we went into Boston the next day and I grabbed Craig Berube and I said, he's not happy. We need to make a stand. He goes, all right, we got it. And we had a line brawl 5 minutes into the game. A whole full line brawl.
Wow.
With Chief and Craig Berube, Dale Hunter, Mark Tenorti. And then we were extremely, Chris Syme, extremely tough team.
Yeah.
That's Olaf Kolza got in a fought Byron Defoe. They were in each other's wedding parties. They're best friends. But that's how it was. Like, okay, we got it. We'll take care of it. Yeah, you don't do things like that anymore. But that's kind of, that's the reality of it. I have two older brothers that, my oldest brother's 9 years older than me. My second brother's 6. Then it's me and my sister. My father always said, I raised, I was kind of two different families. I let you and your sister kind of challenge me more than I let your brothers. Because they kind of grew up in the 50s and the early 60s. And we were kind of late 60s and 70s. And so I'll let you talk a little bit more. So that's my example of generations change. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing. So I think the most important thing as a coach is that, yes, you understand as things evolve and you have to evolve with them. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately it's connecting with a player to help that player elevate. And then the goal is the elevation of that player influences the collective whole. Mm-hmm. And we'll go through that now with a really young team. That's part of the process right now. That's part of the process. And it takes time. Mm-hmm. And everybody wants it fast. We want it fast, but it doesn't always end up like that. So mm-hmm. you also got to know like raising your children, when to be hard, when to give a pat in the rear end, when to soften the message, when to harden the message. You got to kind of go with these ebbs and flows mm-hmm. daily to get the maximum out of your guys individually and then ultimately collectively.
Well, it's great to have that knowledge then, obviously, like you alluded to, coming here and knowing what a young team this is. And, you know, coming here from the Iowa Wild, you know, you were with some younger players too. Yeah. So kind of translating into that, what appealed to you about coming back to Anaheim? Obviously, I know it's a special place for you, but being a part of this team, working with head coach Greg Cronin, I know you mentioned, you know, playing or coaching against him in your past too, but what brought you back?
Crow would call me. I had coached with Team China last year, which was an amazing experience. Again, coaching wise, culturally amazing. And I was going to go back as the head coach of the national team in China. Oh. And I was going to have the U-20s as well. So I was all set. I hadn't signed my contract yet, but I was all set. I agreed to it and so on and so forth. And then Crow called me, says, I think I got something that you might really like. And it kind of fits. It kind of fit what I like to do. I said, well, let me think about it, because I kind of committed to China. Mm-hmm. Let me think about it. So I talked to my wife and she was all dialed in to come back here. I texted him back. Yeah, I think I'd like to, you know, let's go through the process. So then we interviewed early the next week, and then later in the week, he offered, the Saturday night, offered me the job. But what appealed to me was kind of the role I would play, kind of a above everything, kind of in the sense of I would have a, like, I'm up top for two periods. So it kind of gives me a chance to kind of look at everything.
So for those listening to understand your role a little bit, you're in the press box. Yeah. You're watching the game from up there. Yep.
So it gives me, so I have a different, because it's different when you're on the bench and when you're dialed into it. So it gives me a different perspective. You know, Richie Klune's a very talented young coach. Tomer's been around for a long time. Peter Budaj's excellent with the goalies. Julian Trombley's great with our skill development. Austin's a great video, great in the video room, unbelievable. And so I kind of came in with, he wanted me to do the pre-scouts and kind of observe and just kind of troubleshoot, I guess, or a quality control type of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of appealed to me. I'd work with the forwards. I'd do some skill work. I'd work along with Richie. And that was, I liked where it was at this stage of my career. I liked what sort of what it would entail. Mm-hmm. It intrigued me. And I thought it would play to my strengths. I thought I could help, and I was excited to work with Crow. Mm-hmm. And by then, Richie had been hired, and Tomer was already here. So I was excited to be a part of the staff. I watched the team a little bit last year because of Crow, excited with the personnel, excited with the mix, the older guys that have had a lot of success in their careers. We don't have a lot of those mid-range, you know.
Right.
Troy's probably the most prominent at, say, 27, and then young. Mm-hmm. But I like the mix. I certainly like the talent that's in the young mm-hmm. with our prospects and what's coming from behind. So I thought, yeah, it would be a fun coaching challenge. And then I thought the role within the coaching staff would be quite a bit of fun for me. And so, you know, video here and there with guys, Richie and I would work together with some things with the forwards and work with them before and after practice. So it just kind of fit beyond the ice in practice, and it kind of keeps evolving. So that's what intrigued me mm-hmm. and was a no-brainer when he offered me the job to accept it. And then it kind of continues to evolve. So yeah. Now I come down for the third period. So I watched the two, I come down for the third, which I like. Day to day things kind of evolve.
Yeah.
But it's been everything I had hoped it would be. Mm-hmm. We'd like to have more wins right now, but that's the process part. That's mm-hmm. what you gotta work on every day. So it's the best league in the world. It's the best league in the world. And so every day is a new challenge. Mm-hmm. So tonight it's Vegas, it's a new challenge.
Right.
Columbus was a new challenge. You go each step along the way. And every day it changes because teams come in under different circumstances. Like going to Colorado, they're 0-4. They are dialed in. It's game 7 of the playoffs for mm-hmm. them. You go into Pittsburgh and they've just had a miserable road trip. And you've got Sidney Crosby on the other bench. They're coming.
Yeah.
So Vegas is coming off a loss to Carolina the other night. Mm-hmm. So they'll be ready to go. So those are all new challenges with your opponent. But then, putting your team in a position to give it itself its best chance to win. And that's exciting. So, yeah, everything has been terrific from the coaching side of it. I love it. The guys are great. Coaching is teaching. You cannot help but get up every morning and be excited to get to the rink. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the best part. You get to the rink, you can feel your heart. It's bouncing around because you can't wait to get there. It's a new day to something else to teach. Watch your team get better. You get better as a coach. So I think our staff gets along great. So that's been everything. We live over in Irvine by the Spectrum. So we got a great place.
Yeah.
My wife loves it. There's lots to do around there. So kind of everything's come together really, really well. So it was the right call.
Yeah. And then you talking about the teaching side, I mean, you know, the early days for you, maybe, you know, you said politics, but teaching, and then now you are a teacher, really.
You're a teacher. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're presenting and you're connecting mm-hmm. probably even more so than a teacher. And the teachers are probably the most important professionals we have in society, and they're raising our young kids, mm-hmm. right? So they're giving them that education. It's the base, like all of us, right? It's the base of our life. But yeah, you're teaching, and you got to find different ways to teach, and the game's evolving, so you got to stay current with the game, and then you got to find ways to connect with different people. Mm-hmm. And even though kids may come from a certain generation, they're all different too. Mm-hmm. They all respond to different ways, to different methods. So then you got to break it down to each individual. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. And part of coaching, yeah, we're teaching hockey mm-hmm. in the Pierce, but you're also teaching about life.
Right.
So I still get those texts from guys that then now are out retired, working, raising a family. And mm-hmm. they'll say, you know, what you said that, you know, 10 years ago resonates still.
Aww.
And so that ultimately is the greatest reward. Take away the wins and losses, the special awards guys' wins. I've coached 6 Hall of Famers.
Oh,
you know,
who are some of those?
Korea, Solani, Yari Curry here in 96, 97, Jaromir Jagr and Adam Oates in Washington, and Jerome McGinley in Colorado.
Wow.
So 6 Hall of Famers. And Coach Nate McKinnon, he's going to be in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Mikko Rantanen could be a Hall of Famer. I think we might have some guys here, you know, so, incredible, but it's the most rewarding. So through all that, when you've connected to somebody and maybe you've had an impact on their life in some capacity, you get one of your ex-players sends you a picture, they just had a baby. Mm-hmm. You connected with them on a deeper level. I think you're doing good things as a coach when that happens. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that leads to wins. And in our case, a Stanley Cup, another Stanley Cup here. Hopefully that all leads to that. But yeah, that's why you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the method's changed. When I was here the first time, it was VHS tapes. So the staff was only three of us. It was Ron, Al, and myself, Al Sims. There was Brian Hayward was our goalie coach. So Hazy was in was up top, but he would come down and work with Tugger and Guy. And then until Francois Allaire came in, we didn't have a goalie coach in the purest sense. And then we had no strength coach. There wasn't even a weight room in the old locker room.
Wow.
So, and then we had deck to deck. It was all VHS. There was no Exos and Thunder and video. And you can work wherever you want now. You had to be here. I had a big satellite dish now where they're doing all the OC vibe across the street. I had these two big satellite dishes. So I had to stay here to do it. What used to happen, my wife would come over with dinner. Because I would stay through the Eastern and Western games.
Oh, wow.
And then she would come over with dinner. The kids would go skate. They were little. They'd go skate. Oh. I'd shower them. The bath was in the guy's shower. And then send them home. They all go home and go to bed. So that's how it was. Now I can at least go home and work on my computer.
Work from home life work is from pretty home. Good.
Yeah, it helped a lot. When I got to Washington, that started to change. So that helped. That helped a little bit, yeah.
Talking a little bit more about your time in the NHL, I know you talked about your time in Colorado, and I want to specifically bring that up because I know you were there during the 2016-17 season, which was a rough year for them. But you look at the talent they had, the rebuilding process, some way similar to where the Ducks are at right now. What did you learn from that you feel you can bring to the Ducks?
The one thing with Jared Bednar, so... We had gone, I was 2 years with Joe Sacco. I started in 11-12. We had a pretty good year that year. We just missed out. We lost two games to Columbus late in the year, and it kind of cost us the playoffs. We were right in the hunt. The lockout year of 12-13 did not go well for us. And then they made a change. Patrick came in. 13-14, we had a great year. We were in the Central Division. I think we had 112 points. No one expected us to be like that. The next 2 years, we never quite got back to where we had been in 13-14, although we were 90-plus point seasons. We were in the playoff races, but we couldn't kind of seal the deal. We started to lose some players. And then Jared came in. And by then, we were starting to thin out. You know, Ryan O'Reilly had left and made some trades, and they started to make some trades. And eventually, they would trade Matt Duchene the following fall. But Jared came in, and this is another sort of coaching. When you ask, you know, what have you learned from the... Jared came in and we weren't a very good team. He had a game plan. He had a style he wanted to play, and he was going to drive the guys to fit that style. And in time, so we had 48 points that year. It was awful. It was miserable. It was probably my worst year. Probably the worst team I was a part of, but learned a lot. George McPhee, my GM in Washington and Portland, Maine, used to always say adversity is the best teacher. Which is true. You have to go through it, right?
Yep.
Apollo 1 has to kind of burn on the launch pad as bad as it is to get Apollo 11 to land on the moon. You have to have, these things have to happen, unfortunately. This is what happens, at least in our case, human lives, you know, like Apollo 1, it doesn't happen. But still, you've got to go through tough times to become a good team. So I think Jared... he had a way he wanted to play. And so as he cycled into that next summer, the training, the on-ice testing was going to fit what he wanted to do. And even though we weren't winning, he wasn't compensating what he believed was the right way to play. So he kind of built that base, even though we weren't very good.
Now,
that was it for me. I didn't come back. And it was time for me. I worked for three different head coaches in 6 years. Even as for me, it's like, okay, it's time.
Yeah.
And I went to Wilkes-Barre Scranton as an assistant, which was a great experience, which was great for me, which led to the job in Iowa. And then I think Jared identified Nate as the guy that would be the driving force in a sense of his ability, and that Gabe was the driving force emotionally. And from that point, I think once he identified those two guys as the guys that would be, he would build on their backs. And then, of course, we had Mikko scored 20 goals that year. Rantanen scored 20 goals that year. And he was probably our best player that year. And then Mikko's game's evolved now.
Yeah.
You know, he's an incredible talent. So you didn't realize then you knew he was going to be good, but, you know, he's a dominant player now. And then Makar came in. And then they started to fill around it. And JT Comfort was a young guy then. He had a big impact on it. So these guys started to find their way, and they put together what was a great team that would eventually win the cup. They were knocking on the door, then they would win the cup. But I think he had, yeah, like us, some guys established themselves as elite players, which is what you need. And then you have a game, you have an approach. You want to build an identity. I hate the word culture. I like the word identity. You build an identity for your team.
Yeah.
You build an identity for your team on and off the ice. And that's what they did. And then you supplement it, obviously, with your players developing into the from prospects to elite NHL players. Then you fill around them with the guys that complement them. Mm-hmm. And then you have an emotional leader like Gabe Landeskog, and you have a guy like MacKinnon that can drive your engine. And all of a sudden, you're on the cusp of winning the Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm. And then they finally cash in and win it. So that's that year. Although, yeah, when you look at it on paper, it was a terrible year. Led itself. It was the building block to where they are, where they've become, you know, and they're a threat still now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, every year they're a threat at this stage. So, yeah, we're in the – so you have to look at that. It takes some time to get there. These are young guys we have. Leo's 19. You know, we got 20-year-olds. They're young.
Very young.
You know, then you start to get – you get 24, 25, 26. Now you're in the prime of your career. Troy's kind of in the prime of his career at 27, you know, and then you can really start to see what you're going to be. So that those are the things that are encouraging, that it will take time. You're going to have bumps along the way. You're going to have hard patches along the way, but those are what guide you to get to where you want to be. Edmonton's kind of gone through it. Jersey's gone through it a little bit. We're a little bit younger than those teams. But that's what you're trying. Those are kind of the models of where you want to move to.
Tim, for you in your relationship with Cronin, I know we touched on it a little bit briefly, but when did you first meet him, coaching against him? I want to make sure I ask that.
First met Crow in, I think, September of 1988. Mm. At Warwick Vets Rink in Rhode Island, there's a tournament there, and they had two rinks. They had a back rink, and they had the main rink. My brothers and I, we all played high school hockey. My kids would eventually play high school youth hockey and high school hockey there. But there's like a Zamboni room, and he was with Grant Stanbrook, a great, great coach over there at Wisconsin, at Maine. Crow was working for Maine, and I was at PC, and we kind of came through the Zamboni room, and we ran into Grant. I was with Stan Moore, we were assistant partners at Providence. We were working together at Providence, and introduced me to Crow. It's the first time I met him. I don't know if you remember it, but I remember it. And then from that stage, if you kind of map out our careers, we kind of mirrored each other all the way till Crow got the job here. When I was in Portland, Maine, he was in Bridgeport in the American League. And then he was at Maine. I was at Providence up to then. And then he was on the island, and I was in Washington, and then Colorado. He was on the island.
Yeah.
And then he was in Colorado. I went to Iowa. So our careers have kind of mirrored each other since then. And we've always had a good relationship. I think we're both highly competitive. And I'm from that generation where you don't really want to talk to the other team. You know, I don't really want to. And I have coaching friends all around. But it's always after the game that I would go see him. And he kind of understood that. But we would always catch up after a game. If it was in Colorado, he'd come down to see me. If it was in Des Moines, I'd go down to see him. Or if we missed each other, we'd call one another the next day or send a text. So we talk every summer at length. So we've had a good relationship, I think, from that time. And I've known him for a long time. So, yeah, I think he's a terrific coach. Always did. I always say to my guys, we're playing a Greg Cronin team. We better be ready to play. You better have it ready. It's coming, so you better be ready. I think the guys always like that. They're like, you better be ready to go. So to have the opportunity to work for him has been great. And I was looking forward to it. And it's been, like I said, it's been everything I hoped it would be. We got a lot out in front of us. We got a lot of putts still out there. But so we've known each other a long time. And the opportunity to come be with them here, work for them here was really enticing.
A couple last questions for you, Tim, before we wrap it up. I mean, outside of hockey, I know you're a family guy, it sounds like, for sure. But what are some of your hobbies? What other things do you like to enjoy in some free time that you have? Which I know you also mentioned Maine and What a special place that is for you.
Great place. So we've been up there for 10 years. Now, as our kids have moved out and are on their own, so to speak, the grandkids are now the next phase of our life. The nice thing about being a grandparent is when they come spend the month of August with you, if they want a chocolate chip cookie for lunch, they get a chocolate chip cookie. I always say to my daughter-in-law doesn't really love that. I'm like, well, we raised our kids, so now we're going to be the cool grandparents. So in Pittsburgh, because my son's a head coach in Wheeling, Pittsburgh's affiliate in ECHL, he's the head coach in Wheeling. My grandson and my son came to watch us practice the day before the Penguins game. So that was unreal. And my grandson got to skate after practice. And then we went back to Wheeling. I'd see my granddaughter and my daughter-in-law and so forth. So that was great. But yeah, so the opportunity to be a part of our kids' lives as much as we can.
Yeah.
It's just a quick drive down to Boston to see Travis and Ellie down in Boston. They live in Southie. But yeah, I like spending time with my wife. We like to walk. We're both, I think, pretty outdoorsy. I love yard work. I love Maine in the summer, and I love being out in the yard and just doing whatever I can do. I like to play golf.
I like a lot of golf here.
Yeah, I like to read. I love politics. I love reading and kind of studying all the things that are going on. So those are some of my hobbies. With certain things we like to watch on TV. Like we're watching only Murders in the Building now. Like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, love Mad Men. So some of those streaming shows kind of we'll watch. Love sports. A baseball fanatic, Yankees fan. So I'm feeling it a little bit right now.
You mentioned baseball earlier. You're a Yankees guy.
I'm a Yankees fan. So taking on the chin out here right now, but I love the Yankees.
Yeah.
Went to a game with my two boys in August before I came out. Went to go see the Yankees in August. That was my youngest son, Travis, bought that for Derek and I for our birthday. So we spent the night, went to see the Yankees play. It was awesome. So I love baseball. We'll go see the Portland Sea Dogs, which is the Red Sox affiliate, AA affiliate in Portland, Maine. So we go over there a lot. So yeah, lots of different things. Got friends on the lake. We have a bourbon night every Tuesday night on the lake. So me and my buddies, we get together and then we sit by a campfire. We go out in the boat and we just talk.
That sounds awesome.
Or we watch TV, and I'm not really a bourbon drinker. They are, but I'll have a little bit with them and just kind of, it's kind of the camaraderie of being on the lake and talking about a lot of different things. So things like that. My wife plays Mahjong with her friends on the lake and they have game nights. And so it's kind of cool where we live. So all those kind of things. But ultimately, you know, my son, if it's an off night like Saturday, I'm watching his games because if he calls, I can give him, if he has to ask anything, I can give him some advice. So dialed into our kids still, obviously. And the grandkids would be our grandkids. Boonie and Addie would be the biggest joy of our life right now.
Aww. That's so cool that your son followed a similar path to you.
Yeah, my youngest son actually was coaching and teaching at private school. He was at Vermont Academy and then a hockey power, Lawrence Academy, New England Prep School. He did that for 5 years. When COVID came, all his buddies are working in Boston. He wanted to go get out of the coaching, teaching, and prep school, which I was a little concerned about because as a dad, you're like, you got a good job. I don't want you to leave a job and then have... But he went back to Fordham and got his master's in global finance. So he works for a company, MFS, in Boston now. So he was in it. But then, my older boy played 5 years of pro and got one NHL exhibition game in Nashville, played American League, East Coast League, played in Wheeling. And then he got into coaching. When he retired, he played 5 years pro. Then he retired, he got into coaching. That's kind of cool. I actually coached him at Providence College for 1 year.
Oh, really?
He's a freshman. And it's the coolest thing to coach your son on that level because you see them exposed. Like you see your players exposed in this kind of environment. Like you see before the game, you see the anxieties, you see everything with players. You see them on a different level. You see them in the cauldron of the competition. To see your son or your daughter, if you have a daughter and you coach your daughter, to see your son, for me, to see my son like that was incredible. I think we connected on a deeper level because of it. You know, see before a game and you're talking or you're doing a video and your son's got a cross and he's rubbing the cross. You see these things that you don't expect to see. I'd say to my wife, he's different than you think he is. You know what I mean? And so we have that. And now as coaches, we have kind of a connection mm-hmm. kind of in our own little world in a way. So we can talk about things that not everybody can has experienced. So I can talk to him about that. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of neat as a father and son to kind of have that relationship. I have my other son. We have that kind of relationship. That's and I think part of it goes back to us as a family unit, all these years moving different schools, different mm-hmm. places to live, different areas to live, different youth sports, all of this. They both played soccer, hockey, and baseball growing up. So I think it gets you, you connect on a whole different level when it's just you guys and you are in these environments that you're unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. You got to rely on each other. So yeah, that's really cool. And that's been a great experience. And yeah, we can talk about some things that I don't know if every father, son, father, daughter, mother, daughter can, because mm-hmm. we kind of share these experiences. Maybe you can, maybe I don't know. But I know for us, it is, it's kind of a really cool connection.
Mm-hmm. Tim, thank you so much for opening up your life and your journey in hockey and in life to all of our listeners today. It's been awesome getting to know you a bit better. And we're so happy to have you back here in Anaheim.
It's great to be back. Thank you very much.
This is an Anaheim Ducks original production on DuckStream.